Our presentation this morning will be given by Reverend Mary Brubaker. Mary has been an ordained minister in the United Church of Canada for over 35 years. For over 29 years, she has worked in the area of healthcare chaplaincy, providing care for those in spiritual distress. She has worked in pediatrics, bereavement care, mental health, long-term care, cancer care, palliative and hospice care as a practitioner, educator, researcher, and administrator. Mary's topic this morning is, when the healthcare crisis hits, who is there to care for your spirit? Mary will explore the role of the spiritual care specialist, provide case examples of how spiritual care is provided, and outline some of the political stumbling blocks to the provision of spiritual care in this province. Thanks, Mary.
It's so good to be here among you today, and thank you for this opportunity to be with you. For most of us, most of the time, when we get sick, we access the healthcare system. We submit ourselves to whatever invasive or perhaps not very invasive treatment is suggested, and we get better. Most of the time when we get sick, it's not serious. However, when a healthcare crisis strikes us or strikes someone close to us, our spirits are impacted at the very core of who we are. It is these times that a spiritual care specialist can play an important role in helping us to find healing. By spiritual care specialist, I mean someone with professional, academic, and clinical education who has also been through a rigorous certification process and who belongs to and participates in a professional organization such as the Canadian Association for Spiritual Care. It is also important that the spiritual care specialist is accountable for adhering to a published code of ethics and is accountable to a peer review process sponsored by a professional organization. It is incumbent on the spiritual care specialist to be engaged in a program of continuing education and a program of self-care. In a healthcare crisis, the support offered by a spiritual care specialist can help one to find meaning in and make sense of what is happening. A spiritual care specialist can help one tap into one's inner strengths and help one find healing in whatever form that healing takes. The role of the spiritual care specialist is not to give answers, but rather to assist one in finding their own answers. To begin this journey this morning into what spiritual care in a healthcare setting is all about, there are some key definitions that I'd like to leave you with. These are my definitions, based on my reading and understanding of the literature and 29 years working as a spiritual care specialist in healthcare. The first word I would like to define is spirituality. I cannot think of another word in the English language that is so frequently used and yet so misunderstood. Spirituality means different things to different people resulting in a great deal of misunderstanding and confusion. Perhaps one reason why our provincial politicians and our health regions seemingly have no appreciation for the role of spiritual care specialists in healthcare is that the whole idea of what spirituality is so misunderstood. Lest I regress, I offer the following definition of spirituality, which is a multifaceted definition. Spirituality is that part of who we are that engages in relationship. Our relationship with self, our relationship with others, and our relationship with a transcendent power, if that is part of our belief system. It is our spirituality that defines how we find meaning and purpose in life and how we find hope. Our spirituality can include how we understand and practice the tenets of a particular religion in our life, but our spirituality cannot be reduced solely to participation in and belief in a particular religion. Spirituality is much more than religious identity and participating in a religion. Rather, to be spiritual is to be human, and to be human is to be spiritual. While not everyone participates in a religious community, we are all spiritual. Our spiritual identities are defined by what is important in our lives, our relationships, how and where we find meaning and purpose, and how and where we find hope. In healthcare, as in life, when one's spirit is challenged through crisis, we can experience what is referred to as spiritual distress, spiritual pain, or soul pain. All three words are interchangeable as they mean the same thing. For our purposes this morning, I will use the phrase soul pain. Soul pain can be defined as a crisis of the human spirit. It is suffering of the deepest kind. It is a plague deep within. It is a wrestling with the imponderable questions of life and of death. Dame Cicely Saunders, a well-known leader in the care of palliative patients, has coined the term total pain to characterize the multidimensional nature of the palliative patient's pain experience. Total pain includes the physical, psychological, social, and spiritual domains of pain. It is well known in palliative care circles that the most intense of these four pain domains is the spiritual. To relieve or lessen spiritual pain or soul pain results in the lessening of physical, psychological, and social pain as well. This brings me to my final definition, that of spiritual care. Spiritual care is care of the human spirit in a way that addresses one's relationships and addresses where and how one finds meaning and purpose and hope in life. Spiritual care may also address one's religious needs as well, or may include the creation of secular rituals. To put these definitions to the test, I would like to share some stories from my work as a spiritual care specialist. To protect the confidentiality of those I have cared for, these stories are my personal creations, very loosely based on the stories of individuals and families I have worked with over the years. Let me share my first story. Jenny was an 18-month-old toddler who was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor. I met her at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. She was on the infant neurosurgery unit, one of the units where I did regular spiritual care rounds. Jenny was in a 4-bed ward with 3 other infants. Every time I went to see Jenny, her mother, Sarah, was at Jenny's bedside. As with all clients I serve, I introduced myself and my role within spiritual care. Sarah was very clear that she was doing okay and that she and Jenny did not need my services. I said that that was quite fine, that I understood, but that because it was my role to do regular rounds on this unit, that they would be seeing me on the unit. I said I would offer a friendly hello whenever I saw them, but then I left it at that, respecting Sarah and Jenny's right to privacy. I knew, however, from attending the interdisciplinary rounds on the unit, that all that could be done for Jenny, treatment-wise, had been done, and that Jenny was now palliative. One day on my rounds, Sarah approached me, asking if we could talk. She had heard something I said to another mom, and there was something in what I had said to that mom that caught Sarah's attention. Sarah thought that perhaps it might be helpful for her and her husband, Rick, to speak with me. I met with Sarah and Rick on one of the quiet rooms on the unit. As they shared their story, the immensity of their soul pain became evident. The young family had recently moved to Toronto when Jenny became ill. Their home was still full of unpacked boxes, not really a home yet. Rick had a new job that was demanding and with much stress. Jenny was their only child. Sarah, Rick, and Jenny had moved from another province. Their family and friends were miles away. They belonged to a Christian church, but they had not yet had time to search out a new church in their neighborhood. Sarah had no one to talk with face to face. Because she spent her days with Jenny, she had not had time to make any new friends. Rick, on the other hand, had his work to keep him occupied. But work was really not a place where he could talk about Jenny and about how sick Jenny was. While family and friends knew that Jenny was seriously ill, Rick and Sarah had not yet told anyone that Jenny was dying. How do you share that kind of news long distance? Rick and Sarah were full of questions. Why did Jenny get this tumor? Jenny is such a loving little toddler. Why did God allow this to happen? Sarah and Rick wondered what they had done in their lives that was so bad that they would now be punished through the death of their precious child. There were lots of questions. Why Jenny? Why us? Why me? Rick's life was now focused on his work. Sarah's life now was focused on Jenny. Rick and Sarah had virtually no time to be together as a couple, such as going out for a nice dinner together or to a movie. Making love for them now was pretty much non-existent. But they did have one night of passion where they left behind their troubles. Sarah and Rick felt guilty that they had allowed themselves this one night of pleasure, given that Jenny was so sick. It was like a betrayal of their love for Jenny. And now, Sarah was pregnant with another child. How could they prepare a welcoming home for this new child, not yet born, when all of their psychic energy was focused on Jenny and Jenny's dying? How could they be happy for the babe on the way when they were so sad preparing for Jenny's goodbyes? As a spiritual care specialist working with this young family, my role was to provide an environment where Sarah and Rick could share the depth of their soul pain, which was absolutely overwhelming for them. Sarah mentioned to me that one of the qualities she saw in me that she liked was that I am pragmatic. This was a clue to me that Sarah was looking for some practical help in facing the depth of the abyss before her. Sarah and Rick were used to being independent, so it was important to me to help them maintain their independence while also connecting in with others in ways that worked for them. It was important that I help them find areas where they could be in control, given that they had no control over the fact that Jenny was about to die. It was important that I ask the right questions so that Sarah and Rick could find the answers that were right for them. Given the immensity of their soul pain, my role was to help them deal with their soul pain in a way that was manageable and that worked for them. Over a number of meetings, over a number of weeks, I journeyed with Sarah and Rick as they faced their soul pain. In their relationship with others, I helped them plan how they would tell family and friends that Jenny was dying. We discussed how they wanted their family and friends to be involved, how they would convey their needs to those emotionally close, yet geographically distant. in their relationship with one another. I helped Sarah and Rick understand the importance of supporting and nurturing one another, and helped them to discover simple ways to achieve this. In their relationship with the transcendent, I facilitated their expressions of anger towards a God that had left them feeling alone and desolate. I normalized their anger and helped them find some faith-based answers that were right for them. We talked about how in life we are often left with answerless questions. We examined their notion of a punishing God. I offered other alternatives, such as found in Rabbi Harold Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. To address their relationship with self, I suggested private meetings with Rick and Sarah individually. We talked about the grief process and how men and women grieve differently, and how Sarah and Rick each needed to do their own grief work separately from each other. With the help of the nursing team, I assisted Sarah and Rick in developing a plan for Jenny's death that included pain management and how they could provide care for Jenny to the end. Sarah and Rick decided that the nurses would be their support and that they themselves would provide Jenny's nursing care. I helped with the choosing of a funeral home, planning of the funeral, and the writing of Jenny's obituary. In having the details attended to, Rick and Jenny were then able to be emotionally and spiritually present with Jenny to the very end. They were able to say their final farewells in the way that they wanted to, that was meaningful to them. We talked about how to include the baby on the way in Jenny's life. Sarah and Rick decided that they would start a journal for the new baby, telling her or him about big sister Jenny and about how much they love Jenny. They would tell the new baby that through their love for Jenny, they learned so much about love itself, and that it would be with hearts full of love that they would welcome their new life into the family. After Jenny's funeral, I maintained contact with Rick and Sarah for a time, calling them on key anniversaries such as Mother's Day, Father's Day, and the anniversary of Jenny's diagnosis. I referred Sarah and Rick to Bereaved Families of Ontario, an organization which helps parents work through the death of a child. As a spiritual care specialist, it's always hard to say goodbye to families I have journeyed with during such sacred moments. Yet it is important that I allow these families to move on. I said my final goodbyes to Sarah and Rick. My second story takes place in a long-term care facility, that was being closed by the Ontario Ministry of Health. The administration of the facility had been given 3 years to find new homes for its residents. I, along with a number of other healthcare professionals, was hired to form an interdisciplinary team with the mandate to help the residents come to terms with this major life change and to deal with its practical implications. Soul pain was huge. It meant the death of an institution. It meant staff who had worked in the institution for years would be out of a job in 3 years or less. And it also meant that the residents were not only losing their home, but also the caregivers who they had known for a long time and with whom they had deep relationships. It was in this setting that one of the social workers and I defined a need for a particular population of residents. We brought together into a small group setting 8 young women aged 20 to 30 years, all who were severely physically challenged. None of these young women could walk, and so they were confined to wheelchairs. Some of them also experienced upper body paralysis or limitations in their upper body functioning. They all experienced cognitive challenges as part of their complex physical needs. And some of them experienced communication challenges as well, requiring communication devices such as bliss boards. With the news of the facility's closure came feelings of deep sadness and distress, paralyzing fear and anger bordering on rage. These women also came to the group with the baggage of having felt abandoned by their families of origin years back when they were first placed in this institutional home. Their caregivers were their family now, and now once again they were being faced with the loss of family. They felt that the system that had protected them for so many years was abandoning them. Lara, the social worker, and I met with these 8 vulnerable young women twice a week for about a year and a half. The group was a safe place to share stories and feelings, but also to move forward in claiming independence and taking control. Since their placement in this long-term care setting, these young women had become institutionalized because the setting was really run as an institution. The setting's closure afforded these young women an opportunity to move into a group home environment and to shed the shackles of institutionalization. Laura and I used the group to help prepare these young women for what was to come. We helped to reframe that which was feared to that which was going to be an opportunity. Themes of our women's group included dealing with feelings of loss and pain, anger and fear, becoming an adult with my family of origin, learning how to direct my care needs and how to ask for what I need. Becoming the best I am meant to be. Nutrition and meal planning. Finding sources of recreation in the community. How to make friends. Dealing with shopping. How to look and feel my best. Revisualizing the unknown as opportunity. Celebrating hope. And we used HOPE as an acronym. H is for how I help myself. O is for the optimism I see in each new day. P is for the possibilities in each new challenge. And E is for engaging with others. And our final theme was grief and saying goodbye. In our course of meeting together over that year and a half, as a group, we revisited these 12 themes over and over again. Progress was slow, partly because of the challenges of giving voice to those nonverbal group members who communicated only through the use of bliss symbols and bliss boards. However, with each new step forward along the way, these young women grew in self-confidence and reclaimed hope, optimism, and a sense of purpose for their lives. When the group ended, each young woman left with tools to move forward in life in their new homes. I'm only going to share those two stories this morning. I realized as I was writing this that there are many stories, but those were the ones that somehow touched me as I was getting ready for this morning. It is my hope that through these two casebook stories, I have made a strong case for the role of the spiritual care specialist in healthcare. This is not to say that it is only the spiritual care specialist who provides spiritual care. We all have opportunities to provide care of the spirit as friends, family members, healthcare professionals, co-workers, educators, employers, religious leaders, and volunteers. Whoever we are and wherever we find ourselves, we can provide care for the spirit as we care for others. Within our Regina healthcare facilities, we have spiritual care volunteers, community faith leaders, and denominational chaplains providing faith-based spiritual care. From time to time, we also have chaplain interns. Right now, I have 3 chaplain interns working with me. And we have 3 spiritual care specialists, all providing spiritual care to clients of all faith and non-faith backgrounds. I do, however, believe very strongly that there are missed opportunities where those in need and want of a spiritual care specialist do not have access to the service. Some 10 years ago, I did a research study that showed that in the Regina acute care hospitals, that 75% of those wanting spiritual care did not have access to any form of spiritual care whatsoever. spiritual care specialists make up less than 0.03% of employees funded by our local health region. To me, that's a sad statistic. As a spiritual care specialist, I continue to advocate for funding because it's my passion. I continue to educate as opportunities present themselves. And I live in hope that one day the services of a spiritual care specialist will be more readily available when healthcare crisis hits. Thank you. Okay.
So, would there be any comments from the congregation or questions of Mary?
Hi. My sister, who was very close to me, died in 1989. I went to look after her for 5 months and her children because she had cancer that had metastasized. And so when I came back here, I didn't have any support systems there because I didn't, well, her friends were there, but they weren't my friends. And so I had a spiritual care worker that I could see through her hospice program once a week if I wanted. And then when I came back, of course, none of my friends knew her, so it was really hard coming back. But one thing I had to have to say that helped me enormously was having help from the Pasco Hospital, and I wasn't sick, but I needed so much to talk to someone who knew about grief and the devastation I felt at the time. So I'm just wondering, is that still available for people who are, whose families are not even in the Pasco or in this system, but who are suffering from the grief?
Officially, it's not available, but anyone who comes to my door, I don't turn away. We just don't have the resources.
Any other? Hi, David.
Hi, Kate. Hi. You know, get this portable gizmo to speak into it. A comment, but first a kudo. Many years ago, you ran a half-day session somewhere in one of the hospitals, because I remember going to it from the, was active then, the multi-faith forum, I think. And subsequent to that session where I got a lot of confidence in terms of visiting people who are have various challenges spiritually and otherwise, and we were living in Ottawa, I was talking to a person who was like that, and someone who I've known all my life was with me. And she remarked, she's recently deceased, unfortunately, but it was my mother, who was the only woman who'd been with you all your life, remarked, how did you learn all that stuff? And I said, well, I went to this seminar once, I think led by, but it may not have been led by you. And it was really I wouldn't call it necessarily life changing, but close to experience, because it gave some insights on how to deal with people when you're visiting who are unwell. Mm-hmm. The first rule I remember, and I don't know if it was that seminar or not, but I recall it always, is that when you're visiting a person who has issues, they control the conversation.
That's right.
Sometimes as a visitor you have to encourage that or facilitate that, but I befriended a young woman in Ottawa those years who was had multiple disabilities. She was 27 years old, had was blind, cerebral palsy, and used a wheelchair like the one that Robert Latimer's daughter had, and had a ileoconduit, which I gather is an artificial bladder system. Happy-go-lucky most of the time. Regrettably, she did pass away rather suddenly, about a year or so after I started visiting her. But just phenomenal, the skill set to have. It also helps, of course, to be gregarious.
Yeah. I am offering, or our department is offering another similar program. It's 5 Mondays starting either the last Monday in January or the first Monday in Tuesday. That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah.
Just, I'm interested in the work that you did with the women with multiple disabilities in terms of Valley View closure. Have you had any contact with families or people from Valley View?
From
Valley View? It's, yes, in Moose Jaw. And I know it's not here in Regina, but it is an institution for people with intellectual disabilities. There's about 200 people who live there right now, and there is a closure happening in 2016 is the slated date for closure. And there, I have heard certain, people are really unhappy about that happening. So
yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know the facility. I've had no contact. My role is primarily working to provide the level of care that I can at the Pasqua, the General, and Wascana.
Thank you. Wonderful. I've got two small questions, and one is there any healing without spiritual care? So no healings. Is there any healing without spiritual care? And the other one is, you said, why me, when you spoke about Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
How did you become the one?
How
did you become the one who is chosen?
Yeah. Well, we know that tragedy, crisis strikes people no matter what socioeconomic, what country, good people, bad people, if those are labels that, but it strikes across, and who knows why? There are no answers to the why, but under the why is usually deep sadness, deep pain, deep hurt. And the why questions have to be asked, but ultimately there's no answer. And what was your first question? That's a good question. It's a complex question. Because we all have strength and resources from within. So if we don't have access to spiritual care, we rely on that which is within. What good spiritual care does is help one connect with the resources that are always there. And not everyone needs spiritual care. But I hoped that the two examples that I provided showed the complexities and the intensity and the depth of soul pain. And sometimes in those situations, I would say that spiritual care is very helpful. I would like to think that if I was not there, that there would have been somebody else to come in and provide what those individuals needed.
Thank you very much, Mary. You obviously have a very challenging occupation.